Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight Podcast number 220, recording this on Monday, the 30th of July, 2012. Yes, it's not quite a weekly podcast anymore, but who cares? We've got lots to chat about. Chatting with me, we have David Gilson up in Hull.
Hello, Steve. It's good to be here, and hello to everyone at home.
And we have Rafe Blandford down in sunny Sussex.
Oh, well, not quite so sunny here today, but yes, hello, everybody. As Steve said, we're not quite doing weekly. We're sort of aiming for between 10 days and 2 weeks, depending on the news that there is to talk about. But do expect us to be more chatty around some of the topics, as indeed we have already been, being a little more generic. But if you've got any comments on that, please do get in touch, because we'd love to hear your feedback, as always.
And we've had lots of good comments, Rafe. And I don't know if you've been following all the different discussed comment threads on our recent stories, especially on the 808 review parts, but lots of people really appreciating the fact that we're still kind of flying the Symbian flag and keeping the content going, and also emphasizing the flow section, all the new applications, just showing that the ecosystem isn't completely dead, contrary to popular opinion.
Yeah, well, I do try and read every comment on the site, either in the email notifications I get or directly in the threads. Sadly, I don't always have time to reply to everything, but I try to get involved sometimes. But yes, I've also had plenty of emails saying people appreciate hearing about some of the new applications. And I think this is one of the interesting elements. You know, if you'd asked me a year ago, did I think so many Symbian applications would be coming out by this time, I'd have probably been a little bit skeptical, but I'd say there's actually been a fairly constant flow. I mean, compared to the Android and the iOS and even the Windows Phone world, Symbian has never been producing loads and loads of applications every week. It's always noticeably been a smaller catalog size. I think quite often there's been less kind of rubbish applications or spam applications they're sometimes referred to as, but I have been pleasantly surprised by, we're continuing to get emails from developers saying, you know, we've developed this app in our spare time, or even, you know, major releases. People are still, you know, quite active. And I actually asked a couple of developers recently about this, and they said, you know, the thing is about Symbian is, yes, it can still be quite difficult to develop for, although every platform has its idiosyncrasies. And they're actually talking about how, at least these days, Symbian is relatively easy to develop for in terms of fragmentation, because you can target Symbian 3 device and basically you'll get everything that sort of actively downloading applications. It's actually more of a problem in the kind of the feature phone world. Series 40 does tend to be a little more fragmented with different versions around, they were saying. And they contrasted that with Android, where, you know, there had to be many different versions, quite a lot of testing, and similarly with BlackBerry. And obviously iOS is better in that respect, but even there they said, you know, there tends to be a demand to have both an iPhone and an iPad application, which does create extra work. They did talk about download numbers and say, you know, Symbian doesn't provide quite what the others do, but it often, you know, is a very good secondary, tertiary or quaternary app platform to develop for, because there's an awful lot of people out there. I think that's something we've said repeatedly on the podcast. You know, I think Steve sums up this well in his 808 review. He said, you know, yes, this is the last flagship, but a lot of people are still going to want it, and there's a lot of people still with Symbian devices out there. And so while that remains true, I think we won't have any trouble finding stuff to talk about.
Yeah, another quote from the 808 review in a moment. But first, I just wanted to bring David in. And we were talking there about applications steadily coming out. I've been quite surprised, David, just a few off the top of my head. Just from the last month or so, we've seen big updates to FlickerUp. NoteKeeper, of course, has arrived, the big Evernote client, and has been continually updated. We've seen the SkyDrive uploader appear. Fascinate, the Facebook client. FMobi, the Facebook client, both continue to be updated. Tweety, and a brand new Twitter client. Just a never-ending stream of actually pretty decent applications.
Yeah, definitely. I think just to differ slightly from what Rafe was saying, I think I saw the surge in Symbian applications more towards the beginning of this year. I think things have slowed down a little bit in terms of new titles. But as you were just saying, Steve, the maintenance cycle of everything that are the big names currently in the Symbian world has been staggering. It's been amazing to see. And I've just been going through our own tracking system, and I've just spotted two very interesting games come out that I think I might put on my review list as well.
That's a fair point, David. I kind of associate app activity with both new releases, but also updates. And often it's the updates that I notice more, because, you know, that's what I've already got installed on the phone and get notified about it by Nokia Store. I will say, I think some of this activity, at least, is down to the kind of the switch to Qt as the basis of the main developer environment, although there are still Avcon applications coming out as well. That's kind of the old way of programming, if you like, for the Symbian devices. And Qt did make things a lot easier, which does kind of make it sad in a way that Nokia's essentially abandoning Qt. There hasn't been any formal announcement yet, but we understand that's what's going to happen. But in the meantime, it does mean, you know, there's a relatively easy way to program for the Symbian devices, particularly if you then choose to do the UI in QML or QML components. It's not entirely fault-free. I mean, I talk to some developers and say they sometimes come across problems with it, but on the whole, it does make life a lot easier. So that's, you know, perhaps one explanation for why we've seen sort of a renewed burst of activity in what is relatively late on in Symbian's life cycle.
Yeah, yeah. Just going back to my Nokia 808 review part four, which went up on the site yesterday evening as we record this. I'll ask Ray for his comments on my summary in the end. But just to summarise my summary, if I may, I made three main points. The Nokia 808 is undisputedly the best camera phone ever created. Absolutely no one, everyone agrees with that. Even if you go to the most hardened Symbian hater, they agree that. The Nokia 808 is almost as undisputedly the best Symbian smartphone ever made. Again, almost everyone agrees with that. Thirdly, the Nokia 808 is admittedly something of an oddity in the smartphone landscape. It's miles behind in terms of camera technology and other components, but arguably a year or two behind in terms of interface and applications. And I'll just quote this last couple of paragraphs. This is quite important, I think, and then we can go to Rafe's comments. I've said several times that every operating system has a natural life cycle. Symbian is now arguably about 14 years old. I was back there when Symbian was created in 1997. I got the call from Jezar at Symbian saying, great news, type in this URL name, symbian.com. It's been through several near-death experiences already. Looked at in this fashion, it's somewhat remarkable that Symbian is still in use in a device which is still impressing people in 2012, 14 years later. Its core code is no doubt more than a little fragile by now, after numerous changes of form factor interface, and the situation hasn't been helped by Nokia's decision to drastically reduce Symbian OS development over the last 18 months. It's unlikely we'll see more than the updates I mentioned in the review part, and even more unlikely we'll actually see another Symbian-powered smartphone. But all of this does mean that Nokia 808, outrageous highlights and disappointing lowlights, is it. Many of us will stay using Symbian in the short term. Some may even carry on using the OS into 2013 and 2014 and beyond. And the installed base of Symbian owners remains huge. But if the official roster of Symbian-powered hardware had to come to an end, then what a way to go. Not with a whimper, but with a rather impressive 41-megapixel bang. Ray.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been following Symbian for almost as many years as Steve, and I'm very pleased that it had something to end on that I think will always be considered a high note. And this is something I'm sure people will look back on as a significant device in the history of, you know, mobile computing, just as in many ways that, you know, the 7650 is held up to be the first mass market smartphone. And you can also go back to devices like the Nokia communicators. But I think many of those early Symbian devices, you know, have a fond spot in the memory, but also, you know, were a long way ahead of their time, stuff like the P800. But coming right to the other end, the 808, I think, you know, it does set a new bench in imaging that I think is unlikely to be surpassed in a meaningful way for, you know, quite some time. There will be improvements on, you know, the way it's doing things, and I suspect there'll be more improvements in the software technology. But in my years of covering smartphones, I'm hard-pressed to think of something that was such an obvious technical leap. You know, when you actually use the device, you can see the difference. You know, a lot of the time it's just slow improvements step by step, and this was a generational leap. And I think your comments about Symbian were pretty spot on as well. You know, there's been a lot of press coverage on the 808, which has basically rubbished Symbian, you know, and it's a view that's, you know, pretty easy to defend because you look at it in comparison, you know, to the other smartphone platforms out there, and it clearly does offer a very different experience. But I think it's necessary to add a caveat to all of that, in that for a lot of people, it's precisely what they want. And so there are a lot of people out there who would, you know, very much like the 808. I think Nokia would do well if they can get the price down a little bit, just in the, you know, 6 months ahead. That would be a great move, because I think they'd sell quite a lot of these devices to people who are, you know, on existing Symbian devices, and maybe want one more to be a little bit more up-to-date, but don't yet want to move elsewhere. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And I think, you can also tell this as part of a story of what's happened to smartphones more generally. You know, the idea of life cycles that Steve talked about. I mean, I've talked about that before, and I've sort of said I actually think it's around 10 years that each platform has before it has to go through some kind of radical change. And in one sense, you can look back to, you know, the touch transition with Symbian, and I think it sort of managed that, but everyone knows it wasn't done terribly gracefully. But I'd actually look at a slightly lower level than that and say, you know, Symbian was about running a smartphone or a computer on a mobile device in pretty resource-constrained circumstances, and that's in terms of the processor, the available power, memory. Part of that was about just what was possible technically. Part of it was about doing it within a reasonable cost framework. Now, I think, you know, the iPhone was kind of emblematic of this. We moved to something where you were able to really squeeze the equivalent of a computer in, and that's in terms of the specification of the processor, what it's capable of doing, but also, importantly, the rest of the bits that go with the processor. The kind of the system on a chip became a lot more computer-like in some of the, you know, calculations it could do, you know, some of the bits that go with it. Part of that was about graphics. I think you can overplay that. But thinking about, you know, the rise of dual core and all that sort of thing, it became much more desktop-like. So you could get desktop-like performance out of that, you know, chipset, which just wasn't possible before. And so there was almost this paradigm shift in the smartphone world. And I think that's what really caught Symbian out more than anything else, because it was predicated around, you know, being efficient on, you know, a resource-constrained environment. Those resource constraints haven't gone away altogether, battery being probably the most important now, but they certainly lessen to a great extent. And so actually the modern, you know, mobile operating systems are relatively inefficient. I think you can see that in some of the processors that are required to, you know, to power them now. You know, for a lot of the platforms, you just need a lot of oomph to stop it being laggy. And that's partly about what it's doing. But even in some of the basic operations, you go, how on earth is it, you know, this slow when it's got a really meaty processor, when you think back to not many years ago when it was a couple of hundred megahertz in your processor and, you know, relatively slick. So, you know, I think this whole story about the 808 does tie into that shift. And I think, you know, we'll see something like that happen again in the future, because that's the way the industry works. And I would say, if I was going to flag it up, I think it's probably going to be about the ability to integrate with both the internet and also the physical world. Those are kind of the two big ties for me, at least. And of course, all of the platforms do them, just as Symbian was able to do what we think of as, you know, the standard stuff today, and still does, in fact. But it's about having the, you know, the requirements of the platform itself. And I think it becomes more software than hardware now, is, you know, based around that thing. And that's where Windows Phone gets quite interesting, because it is about, you know, a Microsoft strategy of having a three-screen approach, you know, with your computer, with the TV screen, or rather the box beneath it, and then your mobile device, but also closely linked into the cloud, and that's SkyDrive and everything that's tied in with there. You know, we've seen a lot of that happen on the other platforms. I'm not sure we've yet seen it all properly integrated in a cohesive way, and it has to be cohesive because that's how you create the good user experience, and that's how you get mass adoption of these things. You know, a lot of geeks are already using cloud and, you know, second screen, three screen approaches, but I'm not sure it's really gone mainstream yet. And that's, for me, because it's not, you know, an integral part of the platform experience. It's not an integral part of the user experience. And I'm not saying Windows Phone is there yet, but I do think it's quite well positioned to address that. And so it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the next few years. Would I have liked it being Symbian? Of course I would have done, you know, because I have a great fondness for it. But I think you have to sort of be realistic about it as well. It was the legacy of Symbian was its greatest strength, but it was also its great weakness eventually.
Oh, very poetic. Just to return to the last line of what I just mentioned before, as you said, you mentioned the word fondness there. I think that's appropriate. I've certainly been fairly fond of Symbian over the decade. I've grown up with it and lived with it and you know, been through its latter years as well. I'm so glad that they didn't tail off disappointingly. Imagine if it had been budget handset after budget smartphone, and the last handset released was a £60, you know, resistive screened affair. Very disappointing. As it is, they've gone out with an absolute bang, with something that everyone can see, if nothing else, is a leap forward in some direction. And I'm so glad that we were able to report on that and enthuse over it. And I've got a new gadget to play with for next year or two, which is the best bit of all. Anyway, David, anything to add at all to our ramblings?
I think it's very interesting what Rafe was just saying about cloud ecosystems supporting mobile platforms. I mean, Symbian does have third-party apps that will let you do that, and if you buy one of the more expensive versions of QuickOffice, you can even tap into your Office files that are stored on the cloud. So there are ways to sort of bootstrap all of that onto Symbian. I do wonder in the wider mobile world whether we are running into a possible stall of cloud ecosystems, because the way the internet should work, in my opinion, is that everything should be federated and standardized and work together. But we're getting all of these, let's say, okay, cloud storage, for example, we started with Dropbox. It was just a simple file storage system that everything can use. Then Google and Microsoft have come along and added their own cloud storage services, but with Office document editors on top. So there's a much more compelling reason to use them.
I don't forget Apple's ecosystem. That's another one.
Okay, I'll let the listeners comment on that. But Microsoft and Google systems aren't working well together. If you synchronize Microsoft Office files on Google Drive, you can't edit them unless you actually go into the website and the desktop version and convert it into a Google Docs format. So things aren't working together as nicely as they should. Whereas very Symbian, like I say, Symbian sitting in the background with software which will tap into everything because of a developer community.
Yeah, so the lowest common denominator approach will still work well going forward. That's good to know.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting comment around federation. I think this really ties in with identity as well. It's obviously a hot topic because he who controls identity has an awful lot of power over the users. And I would say it's very similar to what happened on the desktop and is still the case there. I mean, we're kind of used to the internet being a very open environment and the open standards there. And if you look at the desktop, obviously it hasn't been that way. For a lot of users, it would have felt that way because, you know, people have standardized on Windows and Office. And yet, clearly, there's a disruption point if you introduce something else. And I think Google's been the big one there. It will be very interesting to see how it plays out. I have my suspicions that actually most people won't care too much as long as there's some kind of interoperability rather than open standards. You know, if it just works, that's fine by them. And I think, you know, you look at something like the Google document service, it's very noticeable to be at all effective. They did have to, you know, build in integration with Office because that's the kind of the de facto standard. And I expect that kind of pattern to very much continue in the same way that, you know, all of the smartphone operating systems have effectively had to build in Twitter support to some extent or another. And that's obviously a third party service. It is interesting that we have seen this kind of acceptance that you're going to have to integrate with others in order to create a full user experience. I can't think of a single mobile platform now that doesn't have some kind of third-party integration. And I think that is a contrast to kind of the desktop days of old. Look at Symbian even now. It's sort of Facebook and Twitter in Nokia Social. But, you know, Flickr Update was application Steve mentioned, but actually Nokia released with Microsoft a SkyDrive updater as part of kind of the standard platform update. That sort of thing is kind of really just for me a sign of things to come. And I think, Stephen Elop likes to talk about ecosystem wars. It's really just a fancy way of saying, you know, what's the best possible user experience that combines the elements seamlessly together. But I think he's right in one sense, and the platform that wins or, you know, creates the strongest experience is that which makes it easy for users to do what they want to do as painlessly as possible. And, you know, typically users don't respect ecosystem boundaries. So, you know, you'll have your preferred photo uploading service or your preferred email service. And, you know, especially for users of a certain generation, that's a legacy of their internet usage. New users coming in may be a little bit different. You can put them into a bit more of a walled garden, and sort of Apple's enjoyed quite a bit of success with that. But even Apple has very much accepted you need to have third-party stuff in there. You know, look at Google Maps or the Twitter integration in iOS. And so, again, it's going to be very dynamic in the next few years, seeing how that plays out. And I think cloud, as I was talking about in terms of platform integration, is just another step on top of that. And at the moment, it's very much the cloud comes from your platform provider. You know, it's the iCloud in the case of Apple, SkyDrive and associated bits in the case of Microsoft. And Google is, you know, essentially looking to do something very similar with Google Drive and also with the Google Play Store in terms of storing data. And I think we'll see more about that in all the next version of the platforms. But I do wonder if in time, you know, people might become frustrated with that lock-in, and there may be a play for a third-party cloud provider, or at least more interoperability, because, you know, that cloud lock-in will be much more of a lock-in than any app lock-in that you can experience. And I think in terms of transitioning users from one platform to another, one of the really strong things that could be done is to create some kind of, you know, conversion tool, so that, you know, when you buy an iOS device or a Windows Phone device or an Android device, it can ask you, have you already got a Android client, an iOS code, Windows Phone cloud, and convert all your music and movies across, as well as potentially your applications, given that so many applications are cross-platform. Now, of course, there's all sorts of licensing issues built into that. But if you solve that problem and are able then to, you know, convert users from other platforms, that becomes a really interesting, you know, attribute to have, especially as the market is getting more and more mature and there are more people out there who might consider switching for some reason. And obviously this is all talking about software, no consideration of hardware, because I think software has a tendency to come together and you get similar functionality. You know, iOS clearly was ahead in many ways, but there's increasing parity in the other competing platforms. So I think it may end up coming back to hardware. But in order for that to happen, there will need to be some way of getting around this lock-in that I think is only going to get stronger over time. So slightly moving away from the Symbian issue, but, you know, I do find this sort of discussion of where platforms are going and how it's going to work for users in the future absolutely fascinating.
Well, don't worry, I can bring this back to Symbian. Because you were saying about the what gives the best user experience will win out. I do somewhat feel, because of the power of identity services, that the what's in the best the best interests of the corporations are at odds with the best interests of the users. And you almost touched on what I wanted to get at, is that I think there is an area for disruption being created already, because all of these different cloud services, there is a lack of cloud federation. And so there are all lots of different little walled gardens. For example, I've got Windows 8 running on my laptop, and I've got Windows 7 here on my Lumia 800. They're working very nicely together when I'm using Office on both devices, because I'm using SkyDrive. But I also have a Nexus 7 tablet here, and sometimes I want to work on that. And the lack of cooperation between editing Microsoft files on Google Drive is causing a problem there. But there are lots of businesses out there who are trying to bring this together. For example, there's a cloud service called Primerdesk that is trying to bring all of your cloud storage services and your email together in one web interface. I'm not sure that's the way to go, because it's kind of going back to the personal homepage model of iGoogle, for example. But there's another business called Atixo, which I kind of reviewed on All About Symbian, because what that does is take all of your cloud accounts and presents them to you as web dev shares, which we use to view on Symbian through the Davi web dev client, and that's by RevNil. But even so, all of these services, they're presenting all of your cloud services to you in one interface, but they're not actually integrating them together. And I think what you really need is something that's sitting off on the internet somewhere and keeping all of your different accounts in sync with each other. That's what you really need. And I mean, I'm trying to do that at home, because I have my Dropbox. I have my SkyDrive. I have my Google Drive folder as a subfolder of my SkyDrive, and that's a subfolder of my Dropbox. So as long as my laptop's on, everything's in sync. But if I go away from home and I leave a laptop and I turn it off, things aren't in sync while I'm working out of the house, which doesn't happen that often, but the principle is still the same.
I think that's a really good example, David, of how you can create a setup now as a technical user, but obviously it's not practical for the average user, you know, unless they had a lot of help. And so clearly there is potential for you know, services that federate identity and indeed other services. The one issue here, I think, is, well, I think that's possible quite easily on the web because of its relatively open nature. On mobile devices, it becomes a lot more difficult because in order to get a decent user experience, you actually need to integrate quite deeply into the platform itself. I think you could look at something like SkyDrive on Windows Phone and then compare it with how other cloud storage services are implemented on there. And basically, because of limited APIs, they can't provide a very easy round-tripping experience. And you will actually find similar things on other platforms at various levels. You might also talk about how this is almost the second generation of what happened with VoIP telephony on mobile devices. It was only Symbian that ever had true deep integration of VoIP in the sense that you could use it instead of cellular with kind of a completely seamless experience. And if it had been set up for you, you wouldn't necessarily know the difference. You know, once you came in range of the Wi-Fi hotspot, it would log you onto VoIP and all your calls would go out via that. If you moved away and were on the cellular network, it would do it like that. And I think you can, you know, draw something similar for looking at these identity and cloud services in the future. And the thing is, it's not necessarily, as we've said, in the interest of the platform providers to, you know, open up their platforms to have that kind of deep level integration. I mean, none of the existing platforms have the maturity of the Symbian API in terms of being able to affect things at a pretty low level in the platform. That's one of the things that Symbian's kind of legacy or its maturity has really given it. You can have very deep level of integration. You can look at this in some of the applications that are available in terms of networking. VoIP is actually a very good example of that, but there are other areas, you know, integration with the camera as well is, you know, another example. Some of those are limited to manufacturers only, but some of them are generally available to developers. So, you know, I'm a little more skeptical about where this will go on mobile. And, you know, without being too nasty about users, I think a lot of users out there say don't care. You know, a lot of geeks will say, absolutely, I want this open standard. But for a lot of users, it's about what's convenient and does it work for me. I don't see that changing immediately. Maybe a bit further down the road when this stuff has been established. I honestly think that the business models, that which is essentially what we're talking about here when it comes down to interoperability and standards and all this kind of thing, will evolve when they need to, but not before. And we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves, because I think the next generation in mobile is going to be all about, you know, having the mobile device becoming the center of your life. And that, you know, does mean federating all sorts of services and storage, but it can be within the ecosystem rather than, you know, reaching outside it. Maybe that's something that will come in time, but a really, really interesting discussion. And actually, I think the sad thing is Symbian, with the way it was set up, was actually more open to that sort of stuff early on. It did fall behind. But you look at some of the stuff that's in there in terms of talking about the maturity of the API, you can see that the signs of where things were going, and things have stepped back essentially. You know, you don't have the same low level access. Partly that was about security models and everything else. But, you know, shed a tear for what might have been, perhaps.
You are listening to the All About Cloud Services podcast. you're talking about Symbian strengths, Rafe, and even about, you know, processor speed and battery life and so forth. Just in my hands here, while you two were chatting, I've got my Scion Series 3 out. Yes, there's a penny in the Scion jar. A 1993, 8 megahertz. This is Symbian's oldest ancestor in terms of operating systems, some of the core code and core ideas, core modules, the core multitasking architecture. 19 years ago, 8 megahertz processor, full multitasking, incredibly snappy, and that's almost 1,000 times slower in terms of raw megaflops, if you like, than today's quad-core for Android smartphones. Almost 1,000 times slower, and yet it's very, very nippy. I think it's amazing, and that's indeed where some of Symbian's resource management comes from. David?
I just wanted to come back on the compatibility and federation point very, very quickly. I just did a little experiment. I just opened up Word 2013, saved the test document as an open document text format, So completely open source format. Saved it, synced it up to Google Drive, and tried to open it on my Nexus 7 tablet. Will not open at all. So I'm very surprised, and would like to chastise Google for not even supporting the open format.
I definitely listened to the podcast there, so maybe you better chastise them in some other forum. But let's move on for now. Nokia has released its Q2 2012 results. The headline figure for me was actually in terms of device units. They sold 10 million smartphones, of which ironically 4 million were Windows phones, but around 6 million were Symbian. So 18 months after shooting Symbian and out on February 11th, 2011, they're still selling more Symbian than Windows phone. No doubt Rafe can comment on that in a moment, but I guess the headline figure was the financials, Rafe. They had quoted an operating loss of 826 million euros, but the non-IFRS figure was much, much lower. Can you tell me what that figure was and what the difference is between non-IFRS and overall loss?
Yeah, it was a loss of 327 million, which is obviously still pretty big, but it's not quite as big as 826 million. So that's where you'll see the variation in headlines, and that's on sales of about 9.275 billion. Non-IFRS, it's basically just a way of doing accounting that takes out that what's referred to as kind of one-off expenditures. In other words, things that don't fit in the sort of normal operation of the business, and therefore we might expect not to be repeated in future quarters. So this can be things like a write-down from an acquisition. You know, we had that in a couple of quarters ago in Nokia's case. I think it was from the Navtec acquisition, they wrote down about €1 billion worth of value. And that just means when you buy a company, you spend a certain amount and that goes onto your books. If it becomes worth less, you kind of have to account for that. And you know, so you'll have a loss in value in your accounts. In this particular quarter, most of these kind of one-off costs are actually related to restructuring costs, which basically come down to the job losses that Nokia is going through and some of the restructuring it's doing as a result of its new strategy. As you might imagine, when you're, you know, making redundancy payments or you're closing down offices, there's quite a lot of one-off expenditures and also, of course, around restructuring. So a lot of the costs, you know, associated there. There are also some ones with writing down intangible assets in this quarter. And I'd actually expect a fairly similar level, but from different sources, in quarter three. So what it means is that the kind of the underlying performance is actually not as bad as the headline figures would suggest. I mean, it's still a big thumping loss, but you know, there's a double pain here, if you like. Yes, there's falling device sales, which is causing poor underlying performance, but the transition strategy that you're going through at Nokia is actually also costing a lot of money to implement, and hence you get an even bigger reported operating loss figure.
What about my comments on the device sales then, Rafe? Now, I'm not trying to get at Windows Phone here. We all know Windows Phone is undergoing growing pains, and there's this issue with Windows Phone 8, etc. That's a different issue for the All About WindowsPhone.com podcast. But there are 10 million devices sold, of which 6 million were still Symbian, even in mid-2012. And that's not down to the 808, because the 808 wasn't really for sale in very long in that quarter.
Yeah, I mean, that's right on those numbers. Actually, I'm a bit surprised that the Symbian sale figures have dropped off that quickly. If you'd asked me a year ago, I wouldn't have expected them to have fallen quite so far, quite so quickly. In retrospect, it's probably realistic, and I think it's really down to the very strong competition from Android. I mean, if you think about it, until recently, the majority of the Windows phone devices were not competing directly with the Symbian devices because they're in a lower price segment. That has changed a bit now that the Lumia 610 has come along. But again, that impact isn't really going to be felt until quarter three. And obviously, the 808 is a high-cost device, so something of an exception. But as you say, you shouldn't really consider it this time round. The fact that Windows Phone hasn't overtaken Symbian yet was really no surprise to me. I mean, I did expect it to be, you know, selling a few more by now, but you know, the overall performance isn't that bad. It's gone, I think, 1 million, 2 million, 4 million, so it's doubled every quarter. The really critical period is coming up next. It'll be interesting to see what happens in Q3. Everyone's sort of expecting it to be pretty poor, and that's partly because we've got the transition from Windows Phone 7.5 to Windows 8, and also the Symbian sales will probably go down a little bit more too. So it may well be the next quarter where we see Windows Phone go past Symbian. But it'll be interesting to see whether Nokia can maintain that 10 million or increase it. I think they'll probably have to wait until quarter four of this year and then into 2013 before that happens. one of the things that has come out of all of this is how difficult it is to predict these numbers. I think the transition for Nokia has been a lot harder than expected, and the, you know, the kind of decline of Symbian has been a lot sharper than expected. And that's one of the reasons they've had some of these cost issues. And for example, that's seen if you look closely into these results. There's a comment that there's component supply issues. They're actually that they've overawed, and so they've had to allow some costs for that. That's actually across Lumia, Symbian, and Series 40 devices. But that speaks to how volatile things are at the moment for Nokia in terms of trying to look ahead and make predictions. And that's why they're only actually providing an outlook, which is kind of future guidance, one quarter ahead. But it is the same for all the handset manufacturers. If we look at kind of the quarterly results as a whole, which I guess we'll do in a minute, it's evident elsewhere in the industry that things are far from stable.
Riff, seeing as the Windows Phone isn't picking up as quickly as Nokia had hoped, and it isn't matching the decline of Symbian, and given that the losses that they are having ongoing, how long do you think they can... Well, how, let me rephrase. How long do you think Windows Phone has to actually turn around to so Nokia can start turning a profit again?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because there's two separate questions there. I mean, I'd be wary of saying Nokia were expecting, because they never announced what they were hoping to sell, but I don't think it's any secret that they want to sell more of everything. In terms of the kind of the, how long can Nokia keep going, that's really about its cash position. You know, how long can it afford to continue losing money? And actually, one of the kind of the high points, if you like, of these results was it didn't actually decline its cash position. That's how much it has in the bank, as much as expected. It's got about 4.2 billion net cash. That's basically you take your cash, which I think Nokia has about 8 billion or so, and then set it, take away your debts and you get left with your net cash. And that's 4.2 billion. That was about 500 million ahead of expectations. In other words, Nokia isn't burning through its cash quite as quickly as expected. Now, if you look at that over, you know, what period can it keep going for? If it lost 500 million a quarter, it could keep going for 2 years. Now, that's a big assumption that nothing changes, of course, in those 2 years. And it's also a big assumption that someone like Microsoft might not extend it a loan, or there might be other things going on, or sell off another part of the business, like Nokia Siemens Networks, for example, or maybe some of the patents, which are, you know, very valuable. I mean, they alone are reckoned to be worth anywhere between 2.5 to 5 billion euros. So then the question becomes, what about, you know, making a decision on Windows Phone? You'll get a different answer depending on who you ask. I mean, some people will say it's already failed, which I think is rather ridiculous and short-sighted. I think it's probably fair to say that there's a lot of expectation riding on Windows Phone 8, and that's kind of the, if you like, the last flip of the coin. I'm very reluctant to use those terms because there's always scope for doing something different in the future. But there's a lot riding on Windows Phone 8 because that's the point at which the Windows Phone platform becomes a lot more mature. We've not talked about it much in this podcast, but a lot of the things that we consider missing, especially when in comparison to Symbian, are going to get fixed in Windows Phone 8. It's not just about, is it good enough from a technical point of view? We know that many times over, that, you know, the best technical solution or even a sufficient technical solution doesn't always win. So for me, I think you have to look at performance very closely in the first half of 2013. And it's not about, you know, drawing equal with anyone. It's, you know, does it improve significantly over what they did with Windows Phone 7.5? And so that means, you know, being to the point at which they may be selling 10 million devices a quarter by, you know, Q2 of next year, maybe into Q3. And that would be a success, at which point the strategy of Windows Phone will go on. If that doesn't happen, yes, I think then there'll be questions about, you know, what should Nokia be doing. I think Microsoft and Nokia will do everything they can to make it work because it's vital for both companies. You know, people talk about Plan B, and Nokia have even said in some statements, yes, there is a Plan B out there. I think realistically, they both need Windows Phone to work if they're to remain in the mobile ecosystem in a, you know, a significant way. But hey, I've been wrong before, so talking about these pronouncements is very difficult. So I'd be interested to hear what you think, David.
I am curious what the plan B might be. I think that Microsoft is so I won't say desperate, but want so much for Windows Phone to work. I would suspect that they would have a second round of what was the term? Platform payments. Yes, I think they would have another round of platform payments before there was any serious talk about buying the company or selling Nokia off for spare parts.
I agree completely with you. I mean, I think Microsoft needs it to work because their whole company strategy depends on being in mobile. And you know, you don't have to be a genius to work out that, you know, desktop computing is a very mature market. It's not going to go away, but mobile is going to become increasingly important. So they need a stake in that. And yes, I'm sure they would do their best to prop up Nokia and sort of encourage them to stick with it. I think, you know, the plan B for Nokia would basically be it would try and, you know, shift to Android, but I think it would be a much smaller company. Honestly, I don't think that's at all likely to happen. I think, as you say, Microsoft will do everything to prop them up, and ultimately I wouldn't be surprised if Microsoft, you know, bought them to stop them doing anything else. But I think that's actually a relatively unlikely scenario, you know, because people like to think of it in very simple terms. Either it will succeed or it will fail. You know, the real world isn't like that. There are shades of grey, and so there are shades of success and shades of failure. I think, you know, those who expect Nokia to suddenly come swinging back and be enormous again, a little unrealistic. Equally, those who expect it to disappear are being equally disingenuous. I think it'll be a middle ground somewhere in between. And I do think Microsoft will, by hook or crook, and with the help of Nokia, establish themselves as the third ecosystem. But it's going to be a long and very bloody battle, and there's going to be a lot of money needing to be invested in it. And the interesting bit will be how balanced are the two companies at the end. And I think what Microsoft needs to be very careful of is give Nokia enough rope to be independent and be seen to be independent, because I think actually it needs to be careful not to, you know, become too much of a colossus, because that's where, you know, looking back, it had problems in the past, and actually it needs more than just Nokia. So it needs to be on good terms with HTC, it needs to be on good terms potentially with Samsung, and, you know, 100 other OEMs out in China and India that might potentially build Windows Phone devices. But at the same time, they're going to need Nokia as the backbone, because without them, it's basically not viable.
Yeah, I think there's two reasons that they need to, in your words, give them enough rope to be independent, because Nokia is very good at what it does, which is designing phones, both internally and externally. And also, whether you love or loathe the brand of Nokia, the Nokia brand is incredibly well known. It is almost synonymous with mobile phones, and it would be a great loss to whoever is benefiting from Microsoft, benefiting from Nokia, to dilute or lose that identity.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, given that we're on a Symbian podcast, we bring it back to that. A lot of people are very, very much like the Symbian platform, but I think an awful lot of those users are also there because they like the Nokia hardware and the kind of the promise that goes along with it in terms of, you know, durability, you know, and the features. And Nokia has always been a leader in that space, and the 808 is the latest example of that. And I would expect it to continue to be so. Even looking at something like, you know, the polycarbonate casing on the Windows Phone devices and on the MeeGo device, the N9, of course, where it originated, you know, that was an example which has since been copied elsewhere. Now, of course, polycarbonate casing did exist before this, but you can see how that suddenly sort of become a little bit more mainstream. And the best example I can think of is technology that everyone takes for granted in their phones, is sensors, particularly around accelerometers and compasses. That stuff was all pioneered by Nokia. You know, automatic screen rotation would not exist otherwise, quite apart from, you know, the compass and augmented reality and all these kind of applications. So there's still, you know, a lot of potential there, and there's stuff that's sitting in the Nokia Research and Development Labs right now, you know, the nanotechnology up in Cambridge in terms of bendable materials, bendable screens, you know, about cleaning services, and all that kind of thing. And graphene is a wonder material, both potentially for, you know, materials, but also in batteries and all this kind of thing. That still remains really, really important.
Yeah, you mentioned one, or one of you mentioned a plan B there, and perhaps, you know, or maybe a plan C, Nokia running Android. Just note, just a quick anecdote that's on my Phone Show Chat podcast. One of the listeners wrote in and said he'd been quite happily running Android 4.0.4 ice cream sandwich on his Nokia N9. So it can be done. It can be done very well, which is kind of an interesting geek hacking project. But it just goes to show what you can do if you, yeah, if you really want to see a Nokia running Android.
Yeah, actually, I'm sure there's plenty of Nokia devices running Android in one form or another in the labs, and probably other operating systems as well. You know, it's quite easy to do experimentally. It's a little different taking it to an actual product launch. I think one of the interesting points around all of this debate about Nokia has been how many people have said they'd like to have seen Nokia go Android. Now, I think there's an awful lot of geeks who would like that, basically, because the Nokia hardware design is good, and it would have been, you know, a very good Android device. The reason it didn't happen is because it didn't make business sense for Nokia to do so, because would they become the best Android device maker? You can speculate about that, but there's no certainty by any means. And they wouldn't have had the same kind of stake in the ecosystem as they're going to have with Windows Phone potentially. So there's risk either way, and it depends, I guess, which one you consider the bigger risk. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, geeks care quite a lot about what their phone runs on, and that's why, you know, they're saying, I want a Nokia device with Android. I think most people don't. You know, they care that it does certain things and care that they make its life easier, but they don't care what it's using to do that. And so, although, you know, people sometimes have said to me, oh, there's this mainstream demand for a Nokia Android device, I don't think that's really true. I think there's mainstream geek demand, by all means, but when it comes to, you know, the average person, I don't think they're going, oh yes, I want a Nokia device and I want it running Android. They're saying, I want a mobile phone, I want it easy to use, I want to play these games, I want it to do this, I want it to do that. You know, what are the options available? I think it's been particularly pronounced because of the kind of the gaps in Windows Phone. You know, people have been doing direct comparisons, and the geek voice is the loudest on the internet and in any podcast you might listen to. But it's probably worth remembering they are a relative minority out in the big scary world.
One interesting statistic, I'm going to completely make up. One of the numbers in Nokia's results each quarter are the average selling price of a handset. And I know they probably don't break that down by platform, but you've got to wonder that it's somewhere in Nokia, around about Christmas 2012, they're going to look at the statistics of the average selling price of Symbian handsets back in December 2012. And the 808, I think by then, will probably be maybe even up to 50% of total sales of Symbian handsets. So let's say Symbian is now down to, say, 3 million per quarter by then, but 1.5 million of those will be Nokia 808. So the average selling price of Symbian handsets will be a huge blip, a huge spike rate in terms of statistics. Nate, wow, where did that come from? I think it may surprise a few people.
Yeah, I mean, just to give you the figures for this quarter, it was 151 euros, the average smartphone selling price. The average selling price of the Lumia devices was 186 euros, so with a bit of calculation you can work out, it's about 100 to, well, say, let's say 120 euros for the Symbian devices. I think it's a pretty big assumption that the 808 will sell that many, to be honest. And I think the kind of the lower tier Symbian devices will continue to ship in a couple of million units for, you know, quite some time to come. You know, something like the Nokia 603, for example, it's a very fine handset. And those prices, of course, will continue to drop a bit over time. So maybe slightly optimistic to assume it will go up, but it was noticeable that even the average selling price of the Lumia devices was coming down as the kind of the lower cost Windows Phone devices were being introduced. And again, that's one of the things, you know, the company is going to have to, it's all part of managing the transition. It's very tricky doing so. But the bottom line essentially is they need to get device and services back into profitability. And really the best way to do that is to sell more mobile phones, or more smartphones, I should say. Yep, I'm sure the 808 will help with that, but ultimately it's going to be down to Windows Phone in the future. That decision has been made, and that's what the company will be judged on in the future.
And that's a nice point to end the podcast. We're kind of running out of time, guys. It's been a nice freewheeling discussion. We've got several meaty software and application points I wanted to get to, but we'll save them for next week or the next time we do a podcast, and we'll maybe make that more software-focused. In the meantime, it's a goodbye from David Gilson.
Goodbye, Steve. Goodbye, Rafe. And goodbye to everyone at home, and thanks for listening.
Any last words from Rafe Blandford?
Just say thank you to everyone for sticking with us, for listening to me waffle for 20 minutes, or more probably.
Ah, they love you. And a goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield. We'll catch you next time on the All About Symbian Insight podcast.